Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time fjord watcher.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, at least once in a while, seeks out life beyond silver screens, whether they be big or small. In fact, the only movie that Mary Pat and I saw during the first 3 weeks of May was a streaming version of a film that we'd missed in February at the Palm Springs International Film Festival, the Edward Burns drama Millers in Marriage, and I don't recommend it. Nathan, by contrast, spends, by conservative accounts, a dozen or so hours a day immersed in media of some sort, especially so during his recent tenure at the 51st Seattle International Film Festival. He'll tell us all about what he saw and what the rest of us have to look forward to. But first, the three of us are going to discuss the latest, the eighth and supposedly final, chapter in the long-running big-screen Mission Impossible series. Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. Pay no attention to that title. There are plenty of reasons to think that, should there be enough demand, a ninth film will be in the offing. The question is, would it be worth it? The latest installment, directed and co-written by Christopher McQuarrie, who'd helmed the previous three, plays like a greatest hits anthology, with references to all the films that had been produced since the 1996 original. It's big and loud and confusing, yet full of yet more of star Tom Cruise's stunts, the latest ones involving a complex underwater sequence and his well-publicized wing-walking antics, all in service of a plot that feels just a bit cliché. Cruise's Ethan Hunt and his team must struggle to save the world from a rogue artificial intelligence known only as the Entity. Ooh. Some movie fans like to maintain a separation between art and politics, but as my former film teacher Manny Farber used to say, everything is a political statement, and that's certainly true these days. So let's be clear. If Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning were part of a public school curriculum, it would be denied funds by the current presidential administration. DEI, in fact, is alive and well in Hollywood. We have a woman president, played by Angela Bassett, in charge of the country. A woman admiral, played by Hannah Waddingham, in charge of an aircraft carrier. Women with martial arts skills good enough to take down armed marine bodyguards. And everywhere you look, you see brown and black faces. And the characters behind those faces aren't just, as has been Hollywood tradition, sidekicks or mere background flavor. The black actor Ving Rhames plays Luther, whose technical expertise is central to the whole storyline. And the commander of a U.S. nuclear submarine, played by Tramell Tillman, is proudly black as well. And all of this is great news, something I personally applaud, same as I do DEI programs in schools. The film overall, it's a big bag of pre-summer movie popcorn, edited as if thrown into a blender, and memorable mainly for some pretty cinematography and for being the latest exercise in Hollywood excess.
A few things to say about Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. Most important, we did not get the impression in any way that this was going to be the final anything, even though it's the eighth movie in this sequence. Also, we should mention that it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in France. So I don't know what that says about the industry, the festival, Tom Cruise's star power, etc. But it is designed, as Dan pointed out, to be a summer blockbuster, bring it to the masses type of production. And it is filmed and meant to be seen, I think, in IMAX, which is how all of us saw it. Now, okay, fine. Cruise looks good, except he has kind of weird hair. I don't know what's up with that.
And they even comment on his
yeah,
hair.
I know that, yeah. Which was pretty funny because yeah. I was like, yeah, I was wondering about that too. But they sort of, you know, let that drop. But we see some of our usual suspects return, you know, and so we have some familiarity with the character. So this feels comfortable. And of course, as you pointed out, the aerobatic stunts, whether they be in the air or underwater, are pretty amazing, although perhaps a little dragged out for my taste. The problem is the plot of this is just silly to my way of thinking. And as a result of that, I mean, it's a continuation in a fashion of the last Mission Possible Final Reckoning Part 1. But it's this entity, this sort of blob thing that we see, and it never really turns into a proper antagonist. Nor does Gabriel, who's played by Isai Morales, who disappears for a chunk of the movie, and I didn't even know what had happened to him. But it really became wearying to hear everyone tell Ethan / Tom Cruise that he was the only person who could save the world. I was not convinced, I must say that. And the movie is very long. It's 2 hours and 49 minutes, so that's long. And a big shout out to the family behind us with 3 elementary school kids who were very well behaved, despite an occasional kick on the back of my seat, to watch this whole thing. And maybe they were asleep. Maybe that was what was going on.
I don't know.
Why? That's my question, is why. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, you know, I'm glad that we don't do the binary thumbs up, thumbs down, fresh, rotten, yes, no vote on this show, because I really wouldn't know what to give this Last Mission Impossible movie. Because, well, I'll start with the bad, and I agree with a lot of the things that you said. And I was talking the other day with some friends of mine who are huge Mission Impossible fans, and they even had issues with some of the same stuff. So I don't think that we're alone here. And I consider myself a fan, but I'm talking huge fans. Like, they know everything inside and out. I thought the first 90 minutes of this movie, which is the first half of the movie, were both breathlessly paced and a total slog at the same time, because it's unloading all of this exposition. It's juggling dozens of supporting characters. And by the way, this movie really overestimated my emotional investment in these characters that we were just introduced to in the last movie. I don't really care about them that much. And I'm not totally sure if the plot threads come together, because I don't think I could follow them. And it's also trying to remind us of what happened in the last movie. It's like previously on Mission Impossible is like the whole first 90 minutes of this thing.
Well, and the whole series, in fact. I mean, all the throwbacks.
It went back to the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of like a little tribute to all of the different movies. And I would agree with you that Gabriel is not the strongest villain we've ever seen. And whether or not he's even the villain, you're right, it could be this entity thing. It's all just MacGuffin.
Exactly.
But in the second half of this movie, in Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, we get 2 of the best action sequences that I've seen in a long time. And that's the whole point of this franchise. You've got the scene in that sunken Russian submarine, which plays out nearly silently, at least as silent as these kinds of movies get. And I thought it was brilliantly paced and shot. It was like something out of the Poseidon Adventure. And then you get in the third act this jaw-dropping biplane sequence that it could have kept going on. I wouldn't have minded. I had a dumb grin on my face all the way through it. And there were shots in it where I thought, how in the world did they film that? Because it really does look like they're up there. I'm sure there must have been some CGI hijinks going on. But you know that Tom Cruise loves doing his own stunts. I don't know how they did it. And so I come back to the thumbs up, thumbs down thing. I do think that this is not one of the strongest efforts in this franchise. I think the middle section, like 4, 5, and 6, I think are still the best ones. But if you go to a Mission Impossible movie for the action set pieces, you're not going to want to miss the 2 that are in there. So I'm sort of on the fence about it. I think it's a deeply flawed and quite bad movie at times, and then a sensational movie at other times. So what do you do?
Right. And so that's part of the problem. There are sequences in the movie rather than the movie as a whole that
are mind-blowing. But it's kind of always been that way, hasn't it? No,
yes, yes. But, and I have to give a shout out to Hayley Atwell, because she did, I think, most of her own stunts. And she had announced on Jimmy Fallon that she did that long fight scene when she was almost 9 months pregnant. Yeah. So huge shout out to her involvement in this film.
Yeah. You know, I don't want us to come across as these effete movie critics who go, ooh, you know, Jurassic Park, it just isn't artistic, or, you know, whatever. Look.
Why did you have to do that mean impression of me right now? That was so uncalled for. I would never say that about Jurassic Park, by the way.
Well, you know, but at the Seattle Film Festival, I heard people take that exact tone when talking about that exact movie. The point is, this is a film that is just meant to be entertainment, summer entertainment. And so you can't compare it to Bergman. You can't even put it in that. You have to compare it at least to its own franchise. And you did a pretty good job, Nathan, by just saying, in terms of the franchise, this is hardly the best effort that they have. However, parts of it are as good, if not better than anything.
Exactly.
Well, and I do like the fact that they've changed up the locations. I mean, and we get some sense that maybe the White Lotus is poised to break away from the shore island context, and so they could take some lessons from this. There's a
About the streaming White Lotus
HBO show. Right, and I'm also, and I did like some of the minor characters that they
And Simon Pegg is always great. Yep. Ving Rhames, I would watch him always. So.
Well, and then the scientist who had initially gone missing and his wife.
That was a nice little callback.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah. And so there were some good things about it. Again, I think too long and too silly. But
man, the plane scene at the end is so good, it almost makes you forget that you were sitting there for 90 minutes going, so what exactly is going on here? Yeah. Wait, who's that again? You know, sometimes a really
and
great
Tom
action
Cruise,
sequence.
He could still run. I don't know. I don't understand
he does a lot
it,
of it.
But yeah.
Yeah. At any rate, that was our discussion of Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to listen as Nathan shares with us his impressions of the latest Seattle International Film Festival. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I took our respective shots at the latest, the eighth, and supposedly last installment in the big-screen Mission Impossible franchise, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Let's now turn to Nathan, who spent a bit of time over the past week or so seeing films that played at the 51st Seattle International Film Festival. And we have to just jump in here and say, Mary Pat and I didn't go because we were out of the country. And in fact, we haven't been for the last couple of years.
I know. It's amazing that Portugal and Albania and Norway have just gotten in the way of our going across the state.
Yeah, yeah. Place dropper. Go ahead.
Yeah, I go pretty much every year to the Seattle International Film Festival. It's just kind of become a routine for me. And there are some years where I go just for a few days, and I like to see people that live over there and do other things. But this year, I tried to see as many movies as I possibly could. And it helps that because I'm a credentialed press member, I get to watch a bunch of stuff in advance, too. So even if there's something that's playing that I might miss, I can watch it at least from a screener or something like that. So I think total with screeners and actual in-person screenings, if my math is right, I think I saw 24 features this year, which was a lot for me.
Yeah, I think that is a lot. And the festival, let's be clear, it has shrunk in terms of its length. Yeah. But still, during 11 days, they screened 245 films, which seems impossible.
Yeah, because it used to be one of the longest running festivals in terms of duration. Yeah, it would go on for like 30 days. And it's only a couple of weeks this time. But you still can see a lot of stuff. It's, you know, five or six different venues, too. So you can go all over the city and see different things. So usually when I go, my strategy is, because I usually don't have a car, I will usually find one location that's going to have a bunch of movies I want to see and just stay there for the day. So that tends to be my approach.
Is typically Queen Anne?
Yeah, it's usually the SIF Uptown because they've got three screens going, so there's more chances to
see
a wider variety of things.
At Pacific Place because there were at least, two venues there.
Yeah, in the mall. And the Egyptian is out of commission right now, but I hope that comes back. But they also have the former Cinerama Theater, which is now the SIF Downtown. And it's really a trip to go see that, you know, these small independent films on that giant screen. Yeah. So I really love that. But
so
yeah,
what did
so
you
I had
like?
A really good time. Well, I'll start off by going through some narrative features. And two of the best things I saw actually just won awards because there is voting happening throughout the festival.
So audience awards as well as
Exactly.
So I'll start out with the festival's closing night film, which is called Sorry Baby, which won the Seattle Film Critics Society Feature Film Award, which was voted.
How many people are in that?
Well, it was voted on by all the credentialed press who attended the festival. So
including
I voted.
You.
I voted in this as well. And this was one of the movies I voted for. It was written and directed by Eva Victor, who also stars in the movie. She's mostly known for like videos on social media, so I wasn't totally familiar with her, but this is a really strong piece of work. She's a young lit professor at the same New England college that she just attended. And we can tell that she's clearly going through something. And the movie jumps backward in time and then forward in time to kind of tell us what's going on. And the tone of this movie isn't what you'd expect. I'm sort of tiptoeing around details because it does sort of reveal itself slowly as it goes. But it's weirdly funny and also very delicate at the same time. And it's going to be released by A24 theatrically this summer, so we probably will get a chance to review it. Again, it's called Sorry Baby from Eva Victor. And then another movie that won the Best Performance Award at SIFF is called Suleiman's Story. This was another one of my favorite narrative features that I saw. So the actor at the center of this movie is Abu Sangare. He's a first-time actor, amazingly so. And he plays a man from West Africa who has sought asylum in Paris. And we follow him as he delivers food around the city pretty much day and night. He's on his bike going from restaurants to people's apartments.
Like
and
DoorDash, Uber Eats kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. And meanwhile, while he's doing this, he's preparing to justify his asylum status. So he's rehearsing all of these dates and details about his background. And as we follow him, we start to realize that some of those things are embellished or outright fabricated because he's been told your story needs to be really compelling mm-hmm. if you want to justify this. And so the movie is about the French immigration system, which obviously is a
hot button issue right now. Was he coming from Cameroon or did they ever identify?
Guinea. Oh, okay. Guinea. And the movie basically builds to that meeting at the end and you kind of find out what's really going on with this guy. But Suleiman's Story, it feels like a Dardenne brothers movie. If you like their work, you'll really like this. So it's a drama about everyday life. It's obviously very contemporary, but that was one of my favorites. I don't know if this one has a U.S. distributor yet, so I'm not sure when it will be available for a wide audience, but it is streaming right now through the SIFF website, so you can go and watch it. Again, it's called Suleiman's Story.
And the fact that you said it's contemporary, I'm intrigued by the contrast between learning more about the French approach and, you know, what's happening in our own country versus Canada, et cetera. So,
and there were lots of movies. I mean, I don't think that it's unusual, but there were a lot of movies this year, many of which I won't be talking about just for the sake of time, but from around the world that were about federal or governmental systems failing people and leaving people behind. And so it just goes to show you that it's not, you know, simply an American issue, that this is a thing that's affecting people.
Well, and in the last year, we've seen several films coming out of Africa, West Africa in particular. And so I think that that's a shout out to filmmakers who are focusing on that region and those stories. So, but what about Docs?
Yes. You know, of all the movies I saw at SIFF this year in person, the ones that seemed to have the biggest draw, where they were pretty much sold out, were the documentaries, actually. There were a lot of really buzzy documentaries this year. I'll start with the one that was my favorite, which won the SIFF Grand Jury Prize. It's called Seeds, S-E-E-D-S, directed by Brittany Shine. And it was shot over the course of 8 or 9 years in black and white. And it's about multi-generational black farmers in Georgia. And it takes this very lyrical approach where I was thinking a lot about Terrence Malick as I was watching it.
That's high praise coming from you.
Yeah, I'm pointing at documentaries. If you remember Ramel Ross's film, Hale County, This Morning, This
Evening. Yes.
It's very similar to that. It has this sort of poetic, impressionistic approach. And I was thinking of Frederick Wiseman, Charles Burnett, all these different people. But I do think that Brittany Shine will have a really interesting career if she continues, because this is, I think, a really special movie.
Was this the first film up for her?
Yes, and first feature at least. And it's dealing with issues in a way that a typical sort of talking heads documentary approach wouldn't do. And so I think it's really good. I don't think it has a distributor yet, so look out for Seeds. And then another one, which won another documentary award at SIFF, and this one has been a festival hit all over the place. It's called Come See Me in the Good Light. And it's about the poet Andrea Gibson, who is diagnosed with incurable ovarian cancer. And it's just an unflinching look at what it's like to confront mortality in that way. But it's often really, really funny. I haven't heard an audience audibly crying while laughing in a long time, and the movie actually earning it. Like, this isn't some kind of cheap tearjerker. It's really good. It's going to be released by Apple TV in the fall, so you will be able to see it hopefully soon. But again, it's called Come See Me in the Good Light. And then I'll also shout out a movie called The Librarians. This is another documentary, and it's about the rise in book bans in school libraries around the country and sort of how it's connected to school board elections. And it's a really, I think, vital piece of political filmmaking and political journalism in a lot of ways. So that's one to look out for as well. That was a huge sold out crowd. And so I'm sure when that hits streaming, a lot of people will be talking about it, The Librarians. And then finally, another really intriguing documentary I saw, it was the last movie I saw at the festival, called Baby Doe. And it's D-O-E,
okay,
as in John Doe.
Yes.
Baby
not like
Doe.
Pillsbury yeah, Doughboy.
No, not like that. But it's about the strange case of this woman who was, she's a Christian grandmother in Ohio who was linked through DNA to a 30-year-old cold case. And she was charged with the abandonment and death of her own newborn baby decades later. And her family had no idea that this had happened. They had no idea that she had even been pregnant. And it has this true crime hook to it. But I don't think it plays out like a true crime doc at all. And it's a very interesting and provocative look at all of the factors that went into what made this woman do what she did. And I thought it was pretty harrowing and made me feel a lot of different things all at once. So again, Baby Doe, that's another one that I don't think has distribution yet, but I could see it coming out on a streaming service soon. So that's I'm just scratching the surface here, but those are some of the things that really stick out to me. I mentioned it earlier that if you go to the SIFF website now, I think there's like 40 different features and
a bunch
of shorts.
I know, that's amazing. So when did they start doing this? Because it's such a nice addition miss stuff.
It's like a COVID era thing has hung in there. So
and it's SIFF.net, right?
Yes, if you go to SIFF.net, it's right there on the homepage. You can click on it, and there are a bunch of different films available. And you can watch them as digital rentals and also support the festival and SIFF as an organization. So check that out if you weren't able to make the actual film festival in person.
Cool. Thank you very much. At any rate, that was Nathan's report on what he experienced at the recent 51st Seattle International Film Festival. You're listening to Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late, great British writer George Orwell. When I sit down to write a book, I do not say to myself, I am going to produce a work of art. I write it because there is some lie that I want to expose, some fact to which I want to draw attention, and my initial concern is to get a hearing. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.